welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. You know, according to my calculations, at the end of this recording on May 27, 2020, we are in our 11th week of quarantine.
Wow, hard to believe.
How have you managed during this time?
Well, as I've said before, I dug a hole deep down, and I haven't stuck my head out since. I'm the groundhog waiting to peer up and see how many weeks of winter are left.
Well, let me inform you that winter is over.
Is it? I missed that season.
But the quarantine is not, but winter is over.
I don't know. The quarantine winter, the nuclear winter. I don't know what to call it here.
It's the nuclear winter, yes. You know, for me, Paul, this time has provided or maybe even forced a greater opportunity for me to have some deeper philosophical thought. And for instance, the books I'm reading are crazy. I read these books normally, but not four at a time. Like I'm reading right now, and I'm reading Kierkegaard, what? Schopenhauer, Viktor Frankl, and T.S. Eliot, the Four Quartets.
No John Grisham or...
Well, that's what I was... That's funny you would say John Grisham, because I was thinking, I'm in the mood for the calamities of a pleasant John Grisham novel.
Yeah, right. That's what you should be. Nothing too deep, nothing too heavy here. We're already...
My brain just enjoys going into deep thought. Today, and in light of that, today I'd like to initiate what I want to call a two-week series on, instead of conversations in quarantine, it's going to be thoughts in quarantine.
Boy, that's a scary one.
What's that?
I said that's a scary one because you never know what kind of thoughts these sort of pressures bring up from our subconscious. I think sometimes when people are forced to be alone and they're forced under pressure, strange things bubble up.
Either strange things or true things.
Yeah, well, that's
because
true.
We become so inoculated to the feelings of our soul and the feelings of, as we talked last week on intuition, the feelings of intuition, we become inoculated from that. And these times allow or permit those thoughts to rise and have service. So today what I want to do, it's 2 weeks. Today, I'm going to begin the series with you and me discussing two interrelated philosophies.
Okay.
You ready to play philosopher?
I'm ready to play philosophy. Philosophy okay. For $100.
Okay, you're going to take... Yeah, and that probably all on Jeopardy. These are $100 questions, but for you and I, they're $1,000 questions.
Okay, I'll take philosophy okay. for $100.
Philosophy for 100. The first one is on the subject of desire and boredom. And the second one, even more provocative, is on the necessity of suffering.
Yeah, that's hard to imagine here, but you've kind of hinted about that one before.
Yeah. Not to the degree that I'm doing now. Now, next week, Terry Hershey's going to join us, and he's going to take over the lead of the mic, and he's going to interview me on what I consider my unexpected gifts this quarantine has allotted me.
Yeah, well, just like your friend was kind of writing that blog about, what's her name again? I'm drawing a blank. Dina?
Oh, Dina Crotter.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she was saying, you know, that for every, that's my mother's philosophy, to always look on the bright side. There's always some good, even in the midst of something bad here.
Well, you know, as I'm reading Viktor Frankl, you know, there's something, you know, if he can write of positives out of a Holocaust, then, you know, that is, it's really just unintelligible to me. I mean, I cannot put myself... Obviously,
for those who don't know, and I've never read anything by Viktor Frankl, but you and Terry talk about it all the time. Remind us who he was and what the circumstances that gave him to write these books.
Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust, yeah, he's died now, but was a Holocaust survivor. And he entered in 1941. His parents, his pregnant wife, all were killed. And he, within 16 weeks of having released, wrote one of the bestsellers of all time, Man's Search for Meaning. And pretty much the thesis of the book is that we cannot control our circumstances, but we can control how we manage those circumstances, how we view those circumstances, and how we let them impact our life, that we still have choice.
Well, that's very Stoic, isn't it? You're a Stoic at heart here. I remember reading a quote from Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher, and it was something like, we can't change what happens to us. We can only change how we react to it.
Yeah, that's right in line with Marcus.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you read Meditations.
Well, a little bit. You know, I'm a man of many talents here. I know a little bit about a lot of things.
Well, that's a good little bit to learn. I loved that diary. That was an extremely good book. So today what I want to start with is I have given Schopenhauer got me thinking on it, but there's a number of experiences in my life that tie together desire and boredom. And it's really a fascinating concept, and I can't wait for your input on it. Now, let's understand Schopenhauer a bit. Schopenhauer, yes, right, is born in 1788 and died in 1860.
Okay.
And he's probably maybe the most renowned pessimist. And it's not just that he's a pessimist. I mean, it's an official tradition of philosophy. There's pessimism, optimism, nihilism, and one other. And pessimism is not nihilism. Nihilism is a belief that there is no meaning at all. Mm-hmm. Pessimism is a belief there is no meaning, or no, there is a meaning, but it sucks. Now, that's probably not quoting Schopenhauer exactly, but he has a demandingly thoughtful book on the suffering of the world. There are, even though you don't agree with all of his bottom line foundational premises of pessimism, he still brings up great points, just great thoughtful points. And I want to get onto that. But what I'd like to begin with is I'm familiar with a professor and psychotherapist, Dr. Philip Sutherland, who claims, now this is an important concept, who claims we all at our essential core are merely a ball of desire. That is what we are. Before anything else, we are desire. You think of a child, I mean, of an infant. What does an infant want? It is desire. Wants food, wants to be held,
right,
wants to be kept warm, wants to be titled. It's a want. It's a want. It's a want. And that want never discontinues. But as we grow older and we become adults, so let's just skip, you know, the childhood and adolescence phase, and let's move to the adult phase. Desire rules the roost. All of us have desire. We want, and then we discover that we want more. But I'm willing to argue that we don't want more merely because we wish to accumulate, as much as we might argue that we want more because we get bored with what we have.
Okay, that's interesting.
So I think boredom and desire are really uniquely related. And you know, if you want examples, I know you love examples, and mm-hmm. this is just a sentence of it. This is not going through it. But think of sex. You know, after sex is done, you know, for most people,
most men,
let's go to sleep. Yeah, have a cigarette, right, maybe.
Right.
If I've got to that point where I'm still enjoying it, or maybe it's over, let's go to sleep. But in my case, I think of clothes and I think of automobiles. You know how much I love clothes.
Oh,
well, you know, the last thing I need, I won't even tell you how many shirts were in my closet. It would be embarrassing. It would be terribly embarrassing. If I was to buy a shirt, I mean, I could go, let's put it this way, I could go a couple months without ever wearing the same shirt.
And yet, do you really savor them all, enjoy them? Or do you just admire them from afar? It's a collection that you have, or do you experience them and put them all on?
Great question. You know, I don't admire them from afar, but when I do put them on, I enjoy them. I do still enjoy them, but yet I find myself, as a matter of fact, I went out for the first time last weekend and met an individual. We kept our social distancing, and we were at a private restaurant that had a back room that only allowed, he was a known entity, mm-hmm. and only allowed a known entity in there. We were the only two people in the restaurant. And so it was very safe. But I had a desire to stop by my clothing store on the way out and buy something.
Like, see?
You know, just...
So is it an impulse that you just always want something new? It's like giving yourself a present every week. I used to know somebody, an older woman, who used to buy stuff on the Home Shopping Network, not because she really wanted the things, just because she liked getting presents. And so these things would arrive weekly, monthly, one after another, and she'd get the excitement of opening them up, and then she'd put them aside when she got bored with that. But she was always craving that new.
That sounds exactly right, Paul. That it sounds that her desire is in the acquisition of something new, but she can't find the wherewithal to make use of it, to enjoy it.
Right. The item itself had very little pleasure to her once she opened it. It was the act of getting it. It was the surprise. It was the anticipation. It was the newness of it.
Yeah, exactly, Paul. You get it exactly because, and then after that newness is worn off, then comes in the boredom. I need something new.
Right.
I need something else. I need something different. And I want to go into...
But is that the emptiness of things? You and Terry talk about hint around that sometimes. You know, we are all, Americans are always looking for things, the next thing, the next big thing, the next thing we want. We've always got our things, our stuff we can't let go of here. And yet, and so we accumulate our whole life this series of things, and they don't seem to bring us what we think they will.
Yeah, and then we even have the audacity to hoard them.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a hoarder. You've seen my
without
office
even,
studio.
Without yeah, even, right. Yeah, I know. I've been into your office several times. My office is not much better. It's not a hoarder's office. It's just a totally disruptive, just conglomeration of crap laying all over the place. I have a desire to clean it. But I know once I clean it within a week, it's going to look exactly like it looks right now, so I don't bother.
Yeah, right. Because it's reached its equilibrium. There's something about it that makes us stop. I can't put any more stuff in there. It's full.
Yeah, I don't know if our house cleaner can even deal with it. I don't like them to vacuum because there's too many wires laying around. And they can't possibly dust without moving crap on my desk.
Yeah.
And don't move it because I know exactly where it is and what's there. There's piles all over, but I know what's in the piles.
So there's something about things, the accumulation of things. You say it just springs from boredom, that we're constantly little kids looking for new. Give me something new, and the minute I got to give you a second one, a third one.
Right. Look at Christmas.
Yeah.
Look at Christmas, how quickly kids are... find the present they absolutely love and adore, but then they put it aside to find a new one.
Yeah.
Right. That's what they're going to do, find a new one. I want to give an example, Paul, that I think, you know, it's going to take me a couple minutes to explain, but it's really, I think, one of the most powerful examples. And I read about this in a book of essays by Zadie Smith titled Feel Free. And Zadie Smith writes fiction, but she writes extremely good essays and nonfiction and is quite well known in the publishing industry.
Okay.
And she wrote an essay on this film that came out in 2015 by Charlie Kaufman called Anima Lisa. Now, this film was made with animation. You know, are you familiar with that animation that appears almost but not quite human? That the figures are not, they don't look, you know, they're animated, but they don't look like cartoons. Mm-hmm. They look more like human figures.
Okay.
But they're animated. And what is really interesting of this film, and you know, I'm going to try to make this quick, but I don't know how, because it's so profound, is we have a hero in the story. He's a published customer service expert, as if, you know, and he's very popular, like a customer service expert would be popular. His name's Michael Stone. In this film, Charlie Kaufman, who wrote Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, mm-hmm. and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's kind of an out there thinker.
Very fringe kind of odd films, yeah. Popular films.
Yes.
But yeah.
And in this film, there are three voices, only three voices in the entire film. There is our lead player, Michael Stone. There is everyone else who one voice in the animation portrays, male, female, young, old, wife, child, everybody. It comes from this one voice. Mm-hmm. And then there comes a unique voice that he hears down the hallway, and it's not the same boring voice. Mm-hmm. It's Jennifer Jason Leigh, and her name is Lisa, and she's walking down the hallway of his hotel, and he runs out half-dressed to find her and talk to her, because it's the one voice and that is unique, and that he feels offers him something really tremendous in life.
So everybody else is identical, except for her.
Everybody else is identical and bored. They've already passed through the desire phase. Mm-hmm. They've gone through the desire phase, and they've gone into the boredom phase. This is all exactly the same. And he ends up naming her Anima Lisa, which is a combination of anomaly and Lisa. Mm-hmm. She's an anomaly because she doesn't fit in the rest of the world with her voice. Mm-hmm. And she's a very... She's a very plain, she's not sexy, she's not anything, but she has this incredible voice. And he falls for her, they have sex that evening, and after breakfast, and he's still just so highlighted with her, just so enamored by her. Mm-hmm. And then after breakfast, he starts seeing the eggs beneath her teeth, and she starts becoming human. And her voice gradually breaks down, and we lose her voice, and she becomes the third voice. And so there's only two voices in the rest of the film. And I think this delightfully thought-provoking film really shows desire and boredom. Really shows when I desire something, it's unique, it's new, it's wonderful, it's beautiful. I have to have it. I get it, and then it eventually falls away. How does that strike you?
That strikes me like young love. It strikes me like new love. You meet that girl and she's just perfect, or that guy, or whoever. You meet someone and they're just perfect, and you can't see any faults in them. And your friends go, "Well, wait a minute, but you know they're crazy, or they're this, or they're rude, or whatever." And, you don't see any. You're blind. You just see perfection. And then slowly that perfection starts to melt, and you see them as human, as who they are. They have faults. They have good points. They have bad points. And so then you're off looking for the next fantasy.
I think that's absolutely true in relationship. But what about...
Isn't that what all those episodes of Seinfeld were all about? He was always Jerry Seinfeld in that show was always looking for the next girl. I mean, he was always dating somebody new because sooner or later he got bored with where he was, and he started focusing on all their little, you know, they had something between their teeth, they had something on their nose, and he just couldn't get past that one little thing.
Yeah. I think, you know, Seinfeld is a great example of that. I hadn't thought about that, but I think it's a great. I think Jerry and what's his face
Kramer
really had this in mind.
Yeah, all those guys. Jerry and the guy who wrote it, the other guy who wrote it, whose name is
What's his name? He just and he's got the famous show right now.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank here. He always does the impressions of Bernie Sanders.
He does the impressions of Bernie on SNL. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, come on.
I'm going to look it up. I'm drawing a blank. You're forcing me to think of it here. Larry David.
Larry David.
So, yeah, and they were constantly bored. They were always looking for new, always looking for. And yet they liked, there's something they liked about the familiar, this group, but the group was always on a quest to find something new. They always had some new kick, some new restaurant, some new idea, some new thing they were going to try, and then they try it and they get bored, and the next week they're going to try something else.
So you're right. You're right. So the point is, if we go back to Dr. Sutherland, the point is we are born, created a ball of desire. Now, whether we want to say that's our only thing that we're created with or not, I'm not trying to advocate. I'm just trying to say that is a primary essential need.
But isn't that all id then? It's all just what you want? It's all just that subconscious stuff? There's no brain involved in it? It's just all impulse?
You know, Paul, I'm not really Freudian, and I really have a hard time with the id, the ego, and the superego of making distinctions between them. So that my philosophy lies short there. But if we are this ball of desire, and after only a few moments of entertainment, the desire can enter the ranks of the ordinary and the mundane. As soon as they hit the ranks of the ordinary and the mundane, just another shirt hanging in the closet, ergo results in boredom, and I need another shirt. You know, not just another woman.
Right. Now, how do you explain, though, the thing that you seems like there is the exact opposite of that, though, in shirts or anything else? That one thing that you can't ever get rid of, that one shirt you've always had that's beat up and torn, but you can't throw it away because it reminds you of when you were 12 or you got it some special place or it always. It just fits just right, or whatever, that piece of furniture that you can't give up because it's the perfect chair to sit in Fraser Crane, the old beat-up chair that his dad always sat in. You know, it was just run down and ruined, but it was his. He didn't want a new chair. He wanted the familiar. He wanted the comfort of that shirt that fit perfectly, that chair that fit him perfectly.
You know, that makes me think that, or makes me question, is it that chair or the remembrance of the joy that chair gave to you? Is he sitting in that chair and fully enjoying that chair now rather than a comfortable one? Or it gives him remembrance of a time that his life was filled with joy and pleasure?
Can't tell you.
Like that old shirt. I'm never going to wear that old shirt.
Right.
You know, I have an old varsity jacket laying around somewhere. I'm not going to wear an old varsity jacket.
Right.
But it reminds me of a time. It reminds me of a time when desire was fulfilled before desire was unfulfilled. So I'm wondering, are they really different, or are we really saying the same thing, that it is just looking back at a time that desire was fulfilled and wishing only for that time once again?
Because there are things that comfort us that we just always have had, that meal that you can only get one place. It reminds you of mom's meatloaf or something here. That comfort food, that comfortable chair, that comfortable thing. I know people, habits. It goes to the whole idea of habits. I had a friend of mine who was very well off and loved the good things in life, but he would only drink Miller beer. I'm like, Miller beer's got to be one of the crummiest beers out there. There's all these new microbrewed amazing beer. No, I drink Miller beer. That's it. And I'd make him try it. He'd go, no, it's not the same. just Miller beer, that's all I can drink. There was some bland thing that got burned into his brain, and that's the only thing he wanted. So he didn't crave something new or desire.
I think, you know, in your very first sentence, the verb you used was determine all the rest of what you had to say.
Okay.
Which is reminds you.
Mm.
It reminds you of, it is not in a new experience of, it's reminding you of a time in which you were not, you did not feel bored and consumed with the bore, with the ordinary and the mundane. That was not what your life was all about.
So is that what habits are? Habits are just constant re-loops, replays of something else. So something happens and we get to, I'll give you an example. We do business shows here. Branding. The general theory of branding, I don't know that I accept it, but the general theory of modern marketing, American marketing, has been for years that if you capture somebody young, you've got them for life. If they like your beer when they're young, they will probably drink it for the rest of their life, or your car, or your fill in the blank, anything. So they're constantly chasing the young consumer because somehow they're moldable. The older consumers are set in their ways. And yet that would seem to contradict what you're saying. The older we get, the more we seem to want new things because we've tried it all. And or maybe that's just...
Do you think so? I mean, you're the one who always argues exactly the opposite, Paul.
Yeah, no, I do.
That the older we get, the more set in the ways we are, set in our ways, and we're not open to new and creative and...
I think that's true. I think that's my experience, but you're... If I followed the logic of where you're going, that the more you try and the more you experience everything, it's almost like you get desperate for something new. I've tried everything. Where I got to find something. So you just give up and retreat into the familiar to remind yourself to smell that old blanket once again and bring back those thoughts. Do we give up on seeking the new? And then, therefore, do we give up on desire?
Yeah, right here we need to make a little bit of probably a clarification.
Okay.
I am not advocating this position. I am merely stating this position because I agree with the truth of it. I mean, I agree with the actuality of it, but I think there is a greater truth at hand that will absolve us of this.
Okay.
And let me read a quote by, you know, my oh so dear pen friend that we have no idea who. She has no idea who I am because she has a million followers, but Maria Popova on Brain Pickings.
Yes, right.
And so I was thinking, can we ever truly enjoy fulfillment of desire? And I say yes, but we have to be cautious of what it is we desire. And here's what Maria wrote, that this really struck me, and I sort of paraphrased it and hope it makes sense. She wrote that she has observed we live in a capitalistic, consumeristic model of life that has robbed us of our sense of meaning and is attempting to sell it back to us at the price of a product.
Yeah.
It's robbed us. Consumerism has robbed us of our sense of meaning and now wants to sell it back to us as a price of a product. I think that is what's happening with cars and clothes and all that sort of thing, is we think the product is the essence, is the essential.
And we will take on those characteristics. We will now be free if we ride a Harley Davidson. We will now be handsome if we put that shirt on. Fantasies will come true if we acquire these products.
Yes, if we acquire these products, and then we find out that the products don't satisfy, and that's where you get that very false adage that men and kids are only different in how you define their toys.
Yeah, right.
Or ever how that statement goes. Right. That wasn't quite it. But you know what I was thinking about, Paul, and we'll wrap this thing up on desire and boredom right now.
I'm getting kind of bored with this, but go ahead.
What if we were to desire virtue more than products? What if we were to desire kindness?
Can't make any money off of that, though.
Can't make any money off it. You don't get wealthy off of it. But you can have sort of a divine contentment with happiness, I mean, with kindness, with empathy, with listening, with compassion, with these virtues that are really necessary for life. If we desire that kind of virtue, it is a virtue that continues to give. It doesn't, a product ceases giving.
Well, it's shallow. It doesn't really, it really doesn't have what it was promised to deliver. It's a thing. It doesn't continue to give. It's not a gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, this goes right to our soul. Virtues go right to our soul.
I think you're onto something.
I don't have much on that to talk about the exact virtues, but I do. I'm a strong believer in kindness, compassion, serenity, and non-judgmentalism. That's become, in these days, I'll tell you, that's what's become to me in these COVID days of the far left and the far right. Mm-hmm. The divisiveness is just becoming so almost overbearing for me. I cannot handle, and I know it's a small minority on each side that are doing it, but they're just crazy. They're freaking batshit crazy.
Yeah, right. And the proof of that is you got one segment on one side that says this is fake, it's phony, it's false, it hasn't hit me, so it's not real. I deny the reality of this thing. It ain't that big of a deal. 50,000 people die in a car crash. Who cares? And then on the other side, you have the people saying, well, it's real, but it's there for some other evil purpose here. You're going to use it to create a vaccine. I'm not going to take the vaccine. I'm not taking your vaccine. Your vaccine is there to, it will make me sicker. Will give me diseases. Will hurt me. Will, you know, you can't win either way. One group says, no problem, we don't need a vaccine. The other one says, well, there's a big problem, but I'm not even going to take the vaccine if you do it.
Yeah, I'll take it even a step further that concerns me worse, and we'll end this part of this half of the discussion. Is that there are people that are talking about freedom, and you know public freedom, being able to go out as they want without masks and do whatever they want,
right?
And others that want to be protected. I think the ones that want to be protected and stay at home, I fully appreciate that, and I think that's their value, and that's important that they live by that value. And I think also there are those who want to get out more. I have no opposition to them getting out more. I do have opposition to them getting out more without common courtesy to other people
and common precautions. I don't know why wearing a mask is an objectionable thing. It's inconvenient. I don't like it. I get it. It's not something I'm used to, but it's such a small price to pay for us to be able to walk around, and it not only protects me, it keeps me from infecting somebody else if I've got it.
Well, it's more the latter.
Yeah.
It's really not so much about protecting me as it's protecting others. Do I want to contribute to the illness and, worst case scenario, the death of another person?
But it goes back to what you've saying here. It's all about me. We're living in the ultimate me generation. If it doesn't affect me, it's not real. If it makes me have to, as you say, change my behavior in any way, inconvenience me in any way, I'm not doing it. I don't care about you. It's all about me.
Well, really, it really comes down to that quote that I'll probably use every week is, hell hath no fury like an inconvenienced American.
And I sort of cringed when you said that the first couple of times. And I was thinking this past weekend, Memorial weekend here, as everything started to roll out slowly here, and I went out like everybody else and went to Home Depot. I got some gas and I went to Home Depot. And I came back so angry. I said to my wife, the whole world's gone mad. What did we just go through for the last 2 months? Nobody had a mask on. Nobody was social distancing. Everybody was rude and cutting each other off. You know, it's like, are we just little children? We're all just mad. I won't. I'm going to do whatever I want to do, and you can't make me? There was no concern about me, or people didn't look at me and say, oh, excuse me, here, let me back off or something here. I might infect you.
I might cross your boundaries when I don't necessary, because people seem to believe that your boundaries are not mine and I don't have to consider your boundaries.
Right.
I want to consider your boundaries as long as you consider mine, that I have the freedom to get out as long as I'm not endangering somebody else.
Exactly. Exactly.
If I'm endangering somebody else, that is inflicting my right on someone else. However, if I'm not endangering someone else and I want to take a risk, that's my problem.
Right.
That's an issue. Okay, let's take a break and we're going to move on. Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie in a discussion with Paul Roberts and myself, producer Paul. And we are discussing, this is a philosophical discussion that we're trying to make as practical as possible, but we will see. And we just concluded on desire and boredom, that we are born one ball of desire, and as long as we desire what was illuminated toward the end of the discussion, as long as we desire consumeristic product that we can pay for, our desire is going to wane, and we will be quickly struck by boredom. As a matter of fact, we're going to get into that more now. Now we're going to get into much more of Schopenhauer, the eternal pessimist.
So let me stop you before you go into that. I got to ask you one question. All of this strikes me, just listen to it, because I'm not a student of philosophy as much as you are here, that all we're saying is that we're all born babies. We're all born with nothing more than desire. Feed me, hold me, love me, you know, all these basic things. Maslow's hierarchy of basic needs, shelter me, keep me safe, all these things. Is there no evolution past that? Don't our brains take over? Don't our higher selves, our greater angels, ever lead us beyond that? Or are we just constantly looking for the next shiny object and then disappointed?
I like that question, Paul. I think it's contingent upon where you base your values. And the American dream is based on I've said often that capitalism is not an economic system. It's a social lifestyle system. And that as long as we think we are fulfilling our needs and our accomplishments and our desires by acquisition of stuff,
or status that goes with the stuff, bigger house, bigger job,
all of that power over rather than power to. I'm a big believer in power, but not power over. Mm-hmm. My power to accomplish things and to help. But if we move more toward virtue and existential issues, we have a chance of evolution. Without that, we don't have a chance of evolution. We are just stuck at where we have been for millions or hundred thousands of years.
And we're driven by our desires. We can't get past that. And we're so easily controlled by others who offer us a new shiny product, a new shiny escape, a new shiny object, just like you do with a baby. What do you do to get a baby to stop crying? You say, oh, look over there, and he stops crying because he suddenly forgets what he was crying about and looks at the new shiny object.
And hopefully that's what, you know, for me, and I wonder how many others are feeling it. Hopefully for me, this time of quarantine has allowed me to really ponder those issues and say, what are my beliefs and what do I want to walk away from this thing with? Mm-hmm.
I think it's done the opposite,
Other than I'm a better Zoom participant than I was before.
I think it's the opposite. Based on what I saw this past weekend, which is really the first prolonged time I went out, I think people are children. And all they want to do is, get out of my way. I'm getting out of my house. I'm going crazy. Gimme, gimme, gimme. I want me. And very little thought of, I find in my own life that if you lock me up, I start acting more like a child. I don't become a monk and get into my head and get more cerebral. I eat ice cream. I zone out on TV. I sleep. I eat too much. I devolve. I need to be with other people. I need to be stimulated. I need to be creative. If I just sit still in a confined state, if I was locked in a prison for the rest of my life, I'd get fat and I'd become a dope addict and I'd just try and do anything I could to escape.
To escape, yeah. And you know, is that not the heart of addiction?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. The same thing.
The heart of addiction, it's that I can't face myself.
Right.
And exactly. I can't face my longings, my unachievable longings.
Yes.
What am I going to do? I have to get out of this.
So I think we have a lot of escapism in our society. Because we've created in our modern American society, it's the only one I really understand or have experienced in any depth. We create this, we amp up our desire. We're born with these desires, and we feed upon them. We feed upon emotions and desires, and we're constantly holding these things out. You could be like me. You should want more. If you do this, you'll feel better. And so we create this insatiable appetite for more and for new and for different, the new and improved versions. And then when it doesn't fulfill, we're left to either go buy more, even more stuff, and double down on that theory. I better buy a 10 times bigger car. The house wasn't big enough. I better buy a bigger house. Or somewhere we give up and we try and escape through drugs, through alcohol, through addiction, other kinds
through
of
marriage.
Addictions. Through marriage.
I was just talking to somebody about Elizabeth Taylor and 7 marriages.
Yeah, right. There you go. Right. What would make somebody get married 7 times? You get somewhere along the way, you got to think.
I just heard, this has nothing to do with anything, but I just heard a really interesting story about a guy who gave a speech at Elizabeth Taylor award system, award.
Right.
And there are so many pre-speeches. You know, there's the introduction to her, there's the commentary on her life,
right.
There's the people who put it on. And so by the time the speaker comes up,
yeah. What can you
the
say?
Speaker is like the sixth speaker, and it's the husband. It's the seventh husband.
Okay.
And he's the speaker. People have had dinner. They're tired and all that. And so he says, as the seventh husband of Elizabeth Taylor, you know, I know what is expected of me to do with Elizabeth, but I'm just not sure how I'm going to make it interesting.
Touche. Exactly.
I don't know. What's that?
Exactly. I said touche, right?
I thought you said too sick. It is sick. I want to go over to this other because I think this other is really going to tie in. This other subject is really going to tie into desire and boredom. And that is,
because desire leads to boredom. I can't achieve what I want. And then boredom, I fear, leads to escape. I can't face it. I can't deal with it.
Or the acquisition of other things.
It can drive you more.
And that's what Anna Lisa was all about. Yeah. This guy was at his complete state of boredom, and then he heard this voice that this was the answer to my prayers. This was it, and he was just so elated. He had a whole character change. There was a whole essential nature change to this guy, and then she became human, and she became like everybody else.
Like everybody else.
Yeah.
Disappointment.
So what I want to talk about now is, and we will do this. We can name this tune in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Hopefully.
And what's the title of this? What's the one word phrase that's going to define this?
we're going to be on suffering.
Suffering.
The one word.
All right, I'm taking suffering for 400.
It's
either going to win the game or I'm going to lose. And
suffering for 400. You did pretty damn well at Desire.
Okay.
So, you know, you've doubled your bet. We'll see if I make money on this one.
That's right. This is Final Jeopardy, though. This is where it all comes down to.
Okay. Here's what I'm thinking, that we all suffer is undeniable. I mean, it is part of life.
Part of life.
It's part of the human condition. But in the realm of pessimistic philosophy and the Schopenhauers of the world, mm-hmm. suffering is required for happiness or pleasure.
Oh, I don't want to hear that, because we try and minimize suffering. We try and get through it as quick as we can and pretend it'll never happen again. I'm never going to be disappointed again. I'm never going to lose.
Here's what Schopenhauer writes. He writes, the happiness of a given life is not measured according to the pleasures it contains, but according to the absence of suffering.
Yeah, right. So if I had little suffering, it was a happy life. If I had a lot of suffering, it was an unhappy life.
Yeah, but he also contends this, that the foundational thesis here seems to be that if we knew not suffering, that which is failure, fear, unrequited love, and we can go on.
Loss.
And if we were only to have pleasure, now check this out, if we were to only have pleasure, everything ended up pleasurable and happy in our life. There was no such thing as suffering. It would be merely an ongoing state without comparison, and we wouldn't know we were happy. If you had nothing to compare it to, it's like motor reflexes. I was thinking about anatomical analogies. It's like motor reflexes. I can pick up. I don't think about clicking. I'm drinking a Monster drink. I don't think about picking up my Monster drink. Yet, if something were to happen to my arm, then all of a sudden this would be, if I was suffering in my arm, I had an injury to my arm, lost my arm, say, then the ability to pick up this can of drink would be incredible. But it's not incredible until I don't have it. You know, Joni Mitchell in the Big Yellow Taxi, was it?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what you've got until you've lost.
Yeah.
Until you've lost it. And so the idea is that we are happy or happier or regain, or let me put this, Schopenhauer proposals is that the more we strive for something or suffer from it, the greater the joy or pleasure we have after attaining it. The harder the effort to get there.
We need the suffering to compare it to the... If there's no comparison, if we haven't struggled, then there's no sweetness in victory. If it comes too easy.
How do you know long from short? You know, if everything is long, then everything is. There is no adjective.
It makes me think of something. I, early in my life, was an entertainment publicist. I handled very famous celebrities, Johnny Mathis, Anthony Quinn, Jose Feliz, a whole bunch of people back in the 80s. And I was struck by how few of them were happy. These are people who had, on the surface, achieved everything, fame, fortune, adulation. They could get anything they wanted, do anything they wanted. And so many of them were miserable, like Elizabeth Taylor. They're constantly going through messed up relationships. They're deep into drugs and other things, trying to. Is it Kurt Cobain
Nirvana.
He finally got to Nirvana. He got to experience Nirvana. He got the attention, adulation, the power, the ability to do and create anything he wanted. Without fear, it drove him mad. He couldn't handle it.
What in your observation, what was the issue going on? What do you think they were missing, Paul?
I think it was we could spend a whole show just talking on this, but I think there were several things missing. One was that they couldn't enjoy where they were. They were still, they had struggled and fought. One of the things that all celebrities have in common, for the most part, there are some accidental celebrities more today than ever before, but you struggled to get somewhere. You did. There were lots of, I remember saying when I came to Hollywood, I tried to be an actor, a singer, whatever, because I thought I was really good, and in my high school I was really good. And when I came out here, everybody came from that place. Good was just the ante that got you into the game. Everybody was really good.
Right.
So you had to really want it, or baseball, your son in baseball. You're the best kid in high school, and so you finally go and play at a minor league or something. Now everybody comes from that place. So now you got to have something. You either got to have incredible talent that nobody has, or incredible desire. You got to want it more. The Kobe Bryant syndrome.
You've got to have both. Yeah.
You're the one that comes in to practice 4 hours before everybody else does and stays 4 hours after. You've got this incredible, you've got the desire, you got to work at it. They worked harder at it than anybody else did, and they couldn't turn that off. So no matter how far they got, they were still in that mode of struggle, in that mode of, so they couldn't stop. And I'll give you a classic example. This was told to me by my mentor in the business, who was a very famous publicist. And this is going to take you way back. Maybe this analogy won't mean much to today's generation. Go look him up. Fred McMurray, one of the most famous actors of his time, one of the wealthiest actors of all time.
Wealthiest. Bob Hope and
Fred McMurray.
And Bing Crosby said he's the one with all the money.
He did. Because he bought land, tons and tons of it in the valley and everywhere, and they were bought little bits. So very wealthy, massive moment, big motion pictures he did 3 years, and finally ended his career with a famous series, My Three Sons, you know, all these just accolades. And so they took him out. He got to go out to dinner with Fred McMurray and his wife one night. And he always told me this story. He said, this is celebrity. So Fred McMurray started off very poor like everybody else did, fought his way through the Depression, fought his way through Hollywood, and became one of the richest and most successful actors of his generation. Go out to La Scala, the most expensive restaurant in Beverly Hills at the time. You can't walk in the door without spending $1,000 or something. And it was just at that time, you just knew you were going to spend a ton of money if you went to La Scala. So that's where they went. And they had a fabulous meal. And when it was all over, the waiter came around and said, would you like any coffee? And Fred McMurray turned his cup upside down and said, no, thank you. But my wife will have some. And so he poured some coffee into his wife's cup. And the minute the waiter left, Fred turned his cup over and took half of the coffee in his wife's cup and poured it into his. And my boss looked at him and said, why did you do that? And he said, because they give you free refills here. So rather than spend another nickel or a dollar on a cup of coffee, he was still trying to save a penny, save a nickel. A lot of celebrities like that. Very cheap. Very, very, very cheap. And because they couldn't give up where they came. I thought it was just because they grew up poor and they couldn't get out of that habit. But they grew up struggling. They grew up trying to get ahead, to game the system, to figure out the way in. And they couldn't quit.
That's amazing. You know, I'm kind of reminded of a story as we're wrapping up here about a visual artist. And doggone if I can't, I just can't remember the artist, but he's very popular today. Mm-hmm. And he talked about his best art was when he was in New York, you know, the bottom stories of these townhouses that are actually below the ground.
Right.
And that's what his studios were. And he was not popular. Nobody knew anything about him. Mm-hmm. And he says for the life of him, that's where he produced his best art.
All artists say that. The early years. They always say they were always better in their early years when nobody knew them. Singers.
Well, they weren't trying to compete. And then I heard of a study done by the Getty Museum where they did six or eight, so it would have been like 12 to 16 paintings. Mm-hmm. Half of them were commissioned and the other half were non-commissioned. And then they had this cadre of art critics evaluate the paintings without knowing which were commissioned, mm-hmm. which were regular, and without fail, the non-commissioned paintings were far better than the commissioned paintings.
And you know why? As I'm thinking this out, it's the same thing with authors. It's the same thing with musicians. It's the same thing with painters. Because in the beginning, you're trying to create. Later on, you're trying to recreate. Trying to do it again.
Yeah, and then you get the, you know, the
you second
outliers,
guess. You try and figure out why was I a hit? What can I do it again? Find that magic again. Find that moment. Find that inspiration. You're not exploring. You're trying to do it again.
It's like, boy, all of the complaints that I heard from Bruce Springsteen fans of his latest album.
Yeah.
And his latest album is a Western album.
Is it? Okay.
But it's done with an orchestra.
Yeah.
And people said, Bruce Springsteen is not an orchestra. Well, that's where Bruce Springsteen is today.
Right. And he's trying to push
today.
Now, maybe he's not good at that, but he's trying to at least explore and push the boundaries like most artists do rather than just a great album.
It's really a good album.
So that explains the problem of the What Hit Wonders, too. J.D. Salinger writes one of the most famous books, in, you know, Catcher in the Rye, never writes another book the rest of his life.
How about To Kill a Mockingbird? But then we've got an authorial
argument
there. Did Truman Capote write it, or did, what's her name?
Yeah, right, whose name escapes
me. The one who's supposed to have written it.
Yeah. But again, I mean, so that whole notion of, some people said that's what drove Hemingway mad and why he killed himself. You know, he wrote all his success in a couple of years, and then he went a long, dry spell and couldn't hit it again.
Do you know what his suicide note was purported as saying?
I don't.
Life is one damn thing after another.
Isn't that your whole thesis today here? Yeah.
That really is. And so I would argue for two things for our listeners, and we'll wrap it up because we've gone long, mm-hmm. is that desire and boredom is inevitable as long as we base the acquisition of desire in consumer products.
Right.
If we have, you know, now there's other things, you know, I'm really highly, highly, you know, simplifying here. But if we base it on virtue, character, kindness, love, those are refillable acquisitions. Love is a cup that never, even if it has a crack in it, mm-hmm. it is always full.
Yeah.
It is always, and the more we pour it out, the more it's filled back up again. But another fancy shirt is
hollow.
Yeah, it's hollow. And then the other part is, and as I've read the mystics and people in contemplative prayer, suffering is essential. And, you know, we can talk about it in spiritual terms of identifying with God having come to earth and suffering. This is St. Teresa of Avila said, this is the only, suffering is the only way I can imitate you. And through this imitation, you know, she gains great solace and great intimacy with God in life, that suffering is required. This is part of what it means to be on a flawed planet.
And yet we all aspire for a life without suffering, particularly here in America. We can't accept suffering. We don't know how to face it. We don't know how to deal with it. When others are suffering, we leave them alone because I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do, and I don't want them to bring me down.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if it's what, you know, maybe it's I don't want to bring them to me to bring for them to bring me down, but I don't want to bring them down. It's fear, and it's why we never use the word death. I mean, I never. I go crazy every time I hear pass away.
No,
they
I
didn't
do
pass
too.
Away. They died.
Yeah, I'm with you.
They died. They're not here. They didn't, you know, pass. Did you see them pass?
I'd love to.
I mean,
do.
Who we did they pass?
We lost Joe. Where did he go?
Yeah, we lost.
We lost him.
That reminds me of a friend of mine who is a pastor just saying it really only remotely has to do with what we're talking about, but he was an evangelist, but who was not a different kind of evangelist. And he said the street corner preacher come up and says, do you want to go to heaven? And he says, well, do you have a bus going right now? I mean, if there's a bus going right now, I might take it.
I'm
but
in.
Otherwise, I don't know that. I don't know. I'm all that interested.
How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice. How do you get
that's
anywhere?
Hey, Paul, that's a good close. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice.
Yeah.
How do you get fulfillment in life?
Practice.
Practice on what's meaningful. Practice on the ethic and not on the product.
I like it.
Let's call it a day.
All right. It's a day. Yet another day with Charlie on his next chapter, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.